Welcome to Morning Show Saturday. I'm Gregory Berg with some highlights from the morning show that's heard every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock right here on WGTD. In late November, I had the great pleasure of speaking with a television producer by the name of Natasha Lance Rogoff. In the early 1990s, shortly after the fall of the old Soviet Union regime, she returned to Russia, where she had lived and worked, to oversee the creation of a Russian version of Sesame Street. Her book about that amazing time is called Muppets in Moscow, the unexpected, crazy, true story of making Sesame Street in Russia.
The workshop was incredibly ambitious. They had then-Senator Biden had spearheaded congressional support for a Russian Sesame Street. But the funding wouldn't be released until we had matching funding from Russian sources, either Russian television or Russian private sponsors. And that was because the U.S. government wanted the new Russian government to have skin in the game. And within the workshop, there was not a consensus on the what type of production Ulitsa Sezam, which means Sesame Street in Russian, should be. The difference was one executive wanted the show to be limited production, so more dubbed material from the American show. And the other executive wanted it to be a whole-scale original production with a much smaller amount of dubbed material from the U.S. show. And at the time, like, you, again, you give me more credit than I deserve for having foresight about how difficult this show would be, because, you know, I just listened to them and, you know, I really didn't have a clear idea of, first of all, I hadn't been in the country for a couple of years. It was a new, independent, fledgling democratic country with a growing market economy. And at this time, lots of bankers and investors and, you know, people buying up raw materials and evangelists trying to, you know, convert atheists, communists to religious awakening. You know, it was a crazy time in Russia.
and it's like everybody wanted to be there in a sense. I mean, not literally everybody, but all kinds of people who probably just a few years earlier would not have even thought of traveling to Russia and investing there and so on. And suddenly it just seemed like fertile ground for all kinds of different projects and possibilities, and an American version of Sesame Street just being one of them.
Correct. Exactly. We were the soft power do good for, you know, Sesame Street is a nonprofit, and, you know, we were there trying to change the way children would think about themselves and their opportunities in the future. And, you know, but there were many other you know, entrepreneurs and bankers and everybody over there that, you know, it was a huge market and they wanted to make money. So this was the environment that I went into. And in hindsight, when I look at, and I talk about this in the book, but, you know, considering the obstacles that we faced in terms of people getting killed, you know, the assassination of our Russian broadcast partner, the car bombing of our first sponsor, and as well as all the cultural clashes that we encountered, it's phenomenal that this actually worked in this environment. So the fact that there were people in the workshop who, from the get-go, had said, maybe this isn't such a you know, good idea, and maybe we should scale back our expectations, I think that I portrayed that accurately in the book. But at the time, at the age I was, you know, and not having any experience, you know, in children's television or with children, I kind of poo-pooed that. You know, I was like, we can do it, you know. Yeah, let's go do it. You know,
right.
This will be great. And let's do, you know, I'll just jump in. And that was, you know, the way I had approached many things in my own personal life, too. You know, I had this theory, this mantra that I would tell myself, which was, you know, if something intimidates me, you have to do it. Like, this was a rule I had. And if my own children had the same rule, I'd be terrified.
You know, I wanted to ask you about this, but in a sense, you've, I think, to some extent, answered it. I wanted to ask you why, as somebody who had lived and worked in what then was the Soviet Union, why you, in a sense, didn't have as much concern. I mean, how you went in with, you know, all of this optimism, and seemingly not completely, but maybe to some extent, kind of oblivious to all of the pitfalls, all of the challenges that were going to face you. But it seems to me, as you're describing this moment in history, it's almost as though you and others were swept up in just the prevailing spirit of optimism by which that was drawing all kinds of people to Russia at this moment in time. And in that respect, it makes all kinds of sense to have this sense that anything was possible at that moment in Russia.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what's difficult to think about now in where we are today is it's hard for people to, either they weren't born yet or they don't remember, but this period when communism collapsed, this is after 70 years of the investment of billions and billions of dollars by the West and by Russia in, you know, nuclear weapons and war and, you know, fighting each other in Afghanistan and all other places. It's really, you know, for territory, I mean, not directly. But this period when the Soviet Union, the Soviet Empire collapsed and you had new countries emerging like Ukraine and Armenia and Georgia, it was, you know, just incredible. It was so much hope. There was hope both in Russia and in the United States that a different future would exist, that Russia would join the free world, that the whole global, you know, economy would work together and collaborate. We had people, you know, who were evangelical about capitalism and expecting that, you know, it was going to somehow rise up and grow in Russia overnight. I mean, there was a great deal of naivete, and this was all happening against the backdrop of extreme poverty, violence, you know, within Russia, and fear of the uncertainty of what was to come in their own country, and the, you know, what would happen for their, with their children and their children's lives in the future. So I think it was, you know, this is a narrative that Putin uses over and over again to justify his autocracy. And that's why, you know, another reason when you ask, why did I write this book? The 1990s are really critical to understand if we want to find a way out of this. It is a window into the historical experience that Russians had, you know, that impacted the following years.
Hmm. We're speaking with Natasha Lantz-Rogoff about her new book, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected, Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Of course, the heart and soul of your book is what you were just talking about coming back to Russia at this momentous era in its history and trying then to launch a Russian version of the beloved children's series Sesame Street. First of all, at this moment in time, we're talking about the year 1993 when you begin this work in earnest in Russia. At that point in time, what did children's television in Russia look like? Was there even such a thing? And if so, did it bear the remotest resemblance to a program like Sesame Street as we saw it here in the United States?
Yeah, it was. There was a program called Spokojnoj Noci Malashi, and it was a very old program that children would watch before they went to bed. The program itself was extremely low production values and didactic, and encouraged the children, you know, to be obedient and then go to bed. There was not a lot of production at the time that we started making Sesame Street in Russia. The studios, film studios, were dark because there was no state funding for film. And before we arrived, television production itself was very far behind the U.S. Television had been used in communism, mostly for propaganda. And while aesthetically it was brilliant, in terms of block print and, graphic designs, the production values were very low, and most people did not use computers at all. So everything, computers, were just starting in the U.S., the computer use in corporations. Email, for instance, but in Russia, nothing. No use of computers in the television station. So everything was handwritten. In addition to that, the longest dramatic TV series that had ever been done was only 12 episodes.
Wow.
So we were going to be producing 52 half-hour episodes. And that had not been done. It was unprecedented.
Wow.
So when we went to our creative team and, began talking with them about this, their reaction was, it's not possible.
Natasha Lance Rogoff is author of Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Also in late November, I spoke with Steve Kemper, the author of Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador on the countdown to Pearl Harbor, telling the story of our ambassador to Japan, Joseph Clark Grew, who was stationed in Tokyo between 1932 and 1942, just before the beginning of the Second World War. So in 1932, President Herbert Hoover decides that he needs to, in effect, transfer Joseph Clark Grew from Turkey, a very important post, to perhaps an even more important post as our lead ambassador to Japan. You say that Hoover appointed Grew to the most difficult post in the world at the time, Japan. I mean, in other words, no diplomat could have faced a more difficult challenge than to be dispatched to Japan. Tell us why this was such a difficult assignment for Joseph Clark Grew. What was going on in Japan at the time that made it, in a sense, a diplomatic maze?
Well, first, to keep in mind, some people might think Germany would be the most difficult post, but it was 32. It was really before Hitler and the Nazis seemed like that serious a threat, whereas the Japanese, after they invaded Manchuria and started shaking their sabers, were literally a huge threat. They were the most powerful nation in the Far East, where the U.S. and Western powers had vast interests in China and in Indochina, in the Southeast Asia. So it was crucial to have someone there who could deal with this immense power, and there was really nobody that could compare to Japan in the entire Eastern Hemisphere, with not the case in the Western Hemisphere. So you needed someone there who was capable of dealing with this power, which appeared to be descending into chaos and militarism and nationalism. Not just appeared to, they were. They had assassinated two prime ministers within a couple of years. They were killing off prominent business people and cabinet members, former cabinet members. The army was seeming to be taking over the civilian government. It was a parliamentary democracy in Japan at the time, but the Diet, which was the name of the parliament, was getting less and less respect from the military, who seemed to be taking foreign policy as part of their bailiwick. Instead of taking orders from the civilian government, they were giving orders to the civilian government. So it was a mess, and it wasn't just a mess because that was happening in the military, it was because it was complete chaos within the military. They were also killing each other within the military. They were assassinating people, generals and officers that the fanatics didn't like, who weren't moving fast enough to fulfill the imperial ambitions of these nationalists. So it was a huge mess there, and that's one of the big surprises for me. You know, Germany was, at least when Hitler took over, there was a strongman form of government. Same thing in Italy. So there was some stability, even though it was a horrifying stability, in terms of the government itself. In Japan, that wasn't true. GRU dealt with 17 foreign ministers in those 10 years because the cabinets constantly were toppling because there was so much chaos and erratic behavior and jostling for power.
Well, and I think if I remember correctly, you tell us also 12 different prime ministers during that decade.
That's right.
Incredible. You write at one point, there were clusters of power, but no central control. Tiers of authority, but no one in charge. For a diplomat looking for the levers of power and influence, the Japanese political system was a maze. One of the things you tell us is that at least part of the source of all of this turbulence and really utter chaos at certain points was the Japanese constitution, the way in which the government had been set up. You really called it the root problem. Tell us when this constitution was put in place and what you see as its most glaring deficiencies that led to these unanticipated consequences.
Go back just a bit. You have to remember that Japan was a feudal society until the 1850s. It was closed to the outside world, literally closed. It didn't let anyone in until Commodore Perry went over there with his black ships and said, "You are opening up. We want to trade with you, and this will be good for you." And Japan, in the course of 50 years, became the power in the Far East and one of the most amazing transformations in history. And they did that by adopting Western principles, Western ways, Western business practices, military practices, educational systems, the whole thing. But it had only been done 100 years, not even 100 years earlier. So you still had, as we know from knowledge about history, you can't just chop off your leg and act like, you know, I'm okay. It's still going to be there. Your history you carry with you into the future. So Japan had this incredibly modern aspect, this modern face, but it also had this incredibly traditional neo-feudal background. And I got a little lost in my own answer there. The Constitution. There it is. So when they adopted a constitutional form of government, the first constitutional form of government in Asia, I think that was in the 1890s, the Constitution made the emperor the commander-in-chief, the leader of the nation, and the spiritual leader of the nation, because, after all, he was a god. They literally considered the emperor a god. And they also put the military under the emperor's rule as commander-in-chief. They thought that was a good thing to do. It would keep the military out of the civilian government. So on the other side, you had the parliament and you had the cabinet. But the the emperor appoints the prime minister. The emperor appoints the prime minister, and so that means that you have this person who has, by the way, he supposedly has all power because he's in control of everything. But on the other hand, he's a god, so we can't let him make any real decisions because he's infallible. And if he's infallible, he can't make mistakes. And the only way not to make a mistake is not to make any decisions. So that was the position of Hirohito. It was impossible. And so because he became a figurehead, more or less, but divine, he was capable of being used in any way that nationalist and militarist wanted to use him. We are acting in the name of the emperor for his good, for the good of Japan, because he is Japan. And so there's this flaw in the Constitution where the military appointed the Minister of War and the Minister of the Navy. The military appointed those two cabinet members. And that meant that all they had to do was withdraw that cabinet member from the cabinet, and the cabinet would fall because nobody else could appoint that foreign minister except those branches of the service. And the military did that a number of times throughout Gru's tenure. So instead of controlling the military with a civilian government, it effectively put the military in charge of government, in charge of will the cabinet live or will the cabinet collapse? And constantly it collapsed because the military pulled its strings.
You at one point in describing this to us in your book, you write, in effect, the prime minister served at the pleasure of the military. And that's a really scary scenario. And, of course, it's kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around the notion that somebody as seemingly important as the prime minister of Japan, in a sense, had relatively no power whatsoever compared to the power and authority of the military.
Well, as long as the prime minister acted in accordance with the military's wishes, then the prime minister was safe. And there were also, it wasn't simple. It wasn't just that simple. There were other ministers who could resist the military. It was always more complicated than simply the military gets to decide everything. Although they had the most power and they did make the most important decisions, they were held in check for a while by the appointment of the prime minister, who then appointed the foreign minister, for instance, who would have a huge impact on dealings with other countries. And so, and the emperor and his advisors controlled that. There was a group of palace advisors, foreign ex officials, usually prime ministers, in fact, called the Genro, G-E-N-R-O. And by the time Gru got there, the Genro had come down to just one person. They had all died off. There was one man left, Prince Seonji. And the emperor would never consider appointing a prime minister unless he had gotten the advice of Prince Seonji. Prince Seonji was a moderate who was he wanted good relations with the U.S. and with Europe, and so he would not allow the appointment of a prime minister who was opposed to that relationship. So there was a time in the early to mid, even almost into the late 30s, where the prime minister could sort of still direct Japan away from complete militarism and expansionism, but not totally, because the army was a wild card and kept acting without the civilian government's approval.
You tell us that right around the time that that Joseph Gru became ambassador to Japan, this is early 1932, that just ahead of that, I think, Japan's prime minister is assassinated, the second prime minister to be assassinated in 18 months. And it seems that at the heart of this kind of activity, and it wasn't even just limited to those two assassinations, was plotters trying to sow chaos and terror that, in your words, would embolden the army to impose martial law. Tell us more about those efforts and to what extent they ultimately were successful.
Well, they were constant, and that's another aspect of this which is so interesting and complicated. There were constantly throughout the 1930s these plots to assassinate political leaders and bring about chaos, which would allow the declaration of martial law. Then the military could take over totally. But there were police from the Home Ministry, and there were the army's military police, the Kempeitai, they're called, who would sniff out these conspiracies and arrest the people involved. So even within the army and the central government, you had police forces who were corrupted by militarism, but not so corrupted that they wouldn't still arrest seditionists. That began to change as the decade wore on. They became closer and closer to the seditionist point of view. So you had it's very fascinating that the army was in conflict with itself, and the army was often in conflict with the Navy. The Navy was always saying the army's nuts. They want to take Japan down the tubes. If we do what the army wants, we're going to have everybody in the world attacking us. And then eventually the Navy went over to the army's point of view too. And that was sort of the beginning of the end for any hope for peace.
Steve Kemper's fascinating book is titled Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. I want to finish out with a highlight from an interview which has yet to air with Andy Saunders, who is responsible for a remarkably beautiful book titled Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record, a book released in honor of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 17, which was the last time that human beings set foot on the moon. Andy Saunders has gone into NASA's frozen vault of photographs and films and taken those original films and digitally remastered them to dazzling effect. The book features 400 images, most never seen before, and none seen in such pristine quality as they are presented here.
But that film, that original film, has finally made it out of the frozen vault and has been digitally scanned to an incredibly high resolution. A resolution whereby everything that's in that film is captured in these digital scans. So in applying the latest digital processing to that, which you have to do because these scans, if you think of it, they're effectively a digital photograph of a piece of film that's in a camera. So and that's the other thing that hasn't happened before is we've taken lower quality scans and people just, turn the brightness up and put them online or print them. But you can't do that with analog film, with a digital scan of analog film. You have to digitally process it. So that's what I've done. With the original flight film, I've also utilized an unusual stacking technique on the 16mm film and just been able to bring out detail that we've never been able to see before.
Hmm. You tell us in the foreword to the book that you looked carefully inspected 35,000 images in order to select, in your words, those which most effectively represent the Apollo program. Can you just take us inside that process? I mean, what sorts of things were you looking for that would, in your words, most effectively represent Apollo and its accomplishment?
Yeah, it was incredibly difficult. I mean, the concept of the book, it isn't just those remastered, the fact that something was really poor and kind of, ta-da, look at how nice it is now. It's not a gimmicky book. There are those moments in it, but the concept is it's the ultimate or definitive photograph record of the whole of Apollo. And so, firstly, there needs to be images from every mission, from Apollo 7 through to Apollo 17. Also, they need to tell the story of each mission. So I researched every photograph and worked out exactly when it was taken, who took it, what is it that we're looking at, what point in the mission is it, and what the astronauts saying at the time that they witnessed these incredible vistas.
My interview with Andy Saunders, author of Apollo Remastered, The Ultimate Photographic Record, will air on Tuesday, December 13th.